morning. So, last time we talked about some assembly topics. We went through AT&T syntax, how that differs from Intel syntax, and that's the syntax our deck spoke and uses in the default syntax for most of the tools on Linux. One thing that came up in AT&T syntax, which is maybe a more generic issue than just a syntax one, is that, labels, that is sort of the names of functions and global variables that we think of as being things we see in assembly as being declared with like foo colon something. This is foo is a label, and then we use it later on. When we're actually generating the machine code, they're basically replaced with addresses, the address of the thing before the colon. We actually sort of declare the label. And this had consequences for, well, if we want to get the address of a label and move it into a register, we use it like it was a number that we're moving into a register. If we want to access memory at the thing the label points to, we use it like it's an address that we're accessing to move into a register. We also mentioned that, x86-64 has these overlapping registers. So we have sort of our main registers, RAX, RBX, and so on, that are 64 bits. And we have names for smaller pieces of them that kind of act as registers. And as sort of a special case, they decided that when you modify the 32-bit pieces, it actually clears out the rest of the 64-bit piece, just as an arbitrary choice. And then we talked about calling conventions. So you may have remembered from 2150 that in order to have function calls work, we need to decide on rules for how parameters and return values get passed to and from functions. And we talked about what the rules were for x86-64 Linux, which is what we'll be using in this class. But you know, these are just rules that someone chose. So we know how to write functions, and we know how to call functions. And we could have chosen different rules with the same processor, and that would have been fine. It's just that we have to be consistent. And one part of these rules, which seems to be a point of confusion, is not just what registers we use for parameters and return values, but what happens to the other registers. And we have to decide that if I want to use a register, is that okay for me to do without doing something about it? And why wouldn't we want to do something about it? Well, someone else might also be trying to use that register. And if we want to let them use that register, we might need to hide that we're using it from them by saving the value and restoring it before they see it. And there's sort of two philosophies we can have on who's responsible for doing that. So one is that we can say that if you call a function, that function can use whatever registers it likes. And that idea says that things are going to be call or save, that when you're calling a function, you need to save stuff. And another idea is this idea that if you're a function, you need to keep all the registers unchanged for whoever's calling you, because they could be doing whatever they want with them. And that idea is call-y saved. And the Linux x86-64 calling convention, like most, has decided to kind of take a point in between these two extremes and say some registers, we have the rule, the call or save rule, where you have to do extra work when you call. And some registers, we have the call or save rule, where you have to do extra work when you're a function that's called by someone else. So questions about those things we covered last time? Nope, we're all set. So based on the quiz scores, at least when I looked at the preliminary scores, I'm going to go over some selected things about the quiz questions. So the first question was about executing an instruction to move parentheses RBX into RAX. So if you remember, our AT&T syntax. This is RAX gets memory at the address specified by RBX. And it asks sort of what do we send messages across this communication space between the processor and memory for? And most people figured out, oh, we have to actually get the instruction or else we can't run it in the first place. It's not on the processor to begin with. And we have to actually get the value of memory at RBX. Most people figured that out. So in this case, RBX is this all B's address. So we asked for that. We don't have to talk to the memory to actually update. I updated the wrong register. That's what I get for making these slides quickly. So we don't have to actually talk to the processor to update RAX because all those registers that we use from assembly are stored on the processor, they're not in the memory. Yes? We don't have to talk to memory. And the processor is the one, and the question is we don't have to talk to processor. The processor is the one doing the work. So it's the one which has the logic to look at the instruction and decide who to communicate with to finish, execute that instruction, what values to compute, and so on. Okay. So then we had 2 through 4 were about endianness, in effect. So we had a variable x, which we were told you was stored in memory at address 50000. And it was a 4-byte int. So that means that we have to divide it up into bytes. Why do we have to divide it up into bytes? Because our memory is divided up into bytes. There's no way of shoving a 4-byte value into one slot in the memory. The slots in our memory are 1 byte in size. So if we have a 4-byte value, it somehow has to take up 4 slots. And in little endian, the way we divide that up is we say, oh, we have this number 1077. I can convert it to hex, just for my convenience. And that hex number, well, I need to divide it up into 1-byte chunks. So my 1-byte chunks are 3, 5, 4, 0, and 0. Just 1 byte, remember 8 bits, so I just said, oh, each hex digit is 4 bits, so I take 2 pairs of 2 of them. And I need to decide, well, what order do I put it in these 4 slots here? And we're using little endian, so the least address slot, so the index 0 slot, gets the least significant part. That's the rule for little endian, so that's why the 3-5 part goes in our plus 0 slots. So questions about this? Yes? Would binary have been equally acceptable? Yes, I thought I included that in the answer key, but if not, I will figure it out when going through special cases. And I guess one point of confusion that I've seen happen that I should address is that when I write a number for human consumption where I'm not talking about it being in a memory that's divided up into bytes, I'm writing it so the least significant part is here and the most significant part is here. The least significant part is rightmost, the most significant part is leftmost, like we do in English and C and every programming language you've used. There's no endianness that applies there. For endianness to apply, we need to have these sort of boxes we need to shove the number in that can be accessed independently. Like the reason we need to care about what goes in the plus zero slot here, rather than just saying it's the least significant part, is because there is a way in the processor to directly access that. And we have to say, what's the answer going to be when I ask for 50,000 hex or 50,001 hex. Okay, so then on question 6. So we were asking to do C equals string of x plus to. A string was a character array that we had a pointer to. X is an index into that array, which we add 2 to. And since character arrays, they're arrays of bytes, so we can take the address of the beginning of the array, which is what's going to be our pointer to the array. We can add X bytes plus 2 more bytes and access memory at that location and put it in C. That's what we should want to do. The first option we gave you, put 2 in a temporary variable, added X to the temporary variable, so now the temporary variable is 2 plus X, and access memory at string plus temp times 1, so this is going to end up being string plus 2 plus X times 1, which is exactly the same as what we wanted at the beginning. So that's fine. The second option does something similar. So we take X, we add 2 to it, so we get X plus 2, and then we're accessing memory at X plus 2 plus string times 1. This is going to compute the same numerical results. Remember, the address computation is just arithmetic. So there's nothing we have to worry about here regarding this REX not really being an index. Yes, the convention is that that slot is intended to be used for like an index into an array, but all the processor is actually doing is just an arithmetic computation. If you have another way of getting the same result, it's still going to work. And then we had our last option, which was not correct. And here, we put 0 in a temporary variable. And then we did this add. And remember, this syntax is a location in memory. So we added to 0 memory at the actual location we were looking for. And that's fine. So if we stop there, we have our result in temp. Unfortunately, the final instruction doesn't extract the result from temp. What it does instead is it accesses memory at the location we retrieved, trying to use it as an address. That's probably gonna crash because that memory location is not valid. Okay. So questions? Not this first question, yes. Can I please wait a second for the last question, last part? So here, in temp here, we have the value we want. We have the actual value of C. We also have some other stuff, but we have the value of C. But rather than extracting the value of C from an 8-byte value, here we're reading memory at using that value as an address. And it's not a valid address, most likely, so this is most likely going to crash. Yeah. So the question is, would this work if without the parentheses? So if I do move B R8 BL, this won't assemble. So the assembler will complain, wait a moment, you're trying to move a 8-byte value into a 1-byte value, because we retrieved 8 bytes from memory, not 1. So, we didn't learn this instruction, but in your textbook, they talk about instructions to move between registers of different sizes and things like that. But the way we could do this is we could say, oh, in this case, I have a big register, and I want only the locally significant 8 bits. And if you remember our register overlapping registers diagram, what we could do is we could move from the bottom 8 bits of R8 into BL, the least significant 8 bits. And because we have little endian, the least significant 8 bits of a value retrieved there are the same bits at the lowest address of that 8-byte value. So that will get us the right value. So that's something we could have done. And you have to remember, or more likely look up, that R8B is the name for the least significant 8 bits of R8. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay. So Our next topic, we're going to talk about the LEA instruction. So I believe many people remember this from 2150 and generally had trouble with it then, and we're going to go over it, especially because it comes up, in particular in the bomb lab and homework. The compiler uses this instruction. So one way of understanding this instruction is to use its name here. So it's load effective address. You might say, what's an effective address? And effective address is an address that is computed during the execution of an instruction. So normally this is an address we'd use to access memory. In this instruction, we're going to just load it into the destination register. But it's the address, so a computed address, you know, from middle of instruction. Middle of running instruction. So, for example, if I have, you know, RAX RCX, and RAX is 10, this is going to compute OX100 plus OX10, that's the effective address. So this instruction, LEA, rather than using that effective address to access memory like that move, it's going to use the address just to be the result of the instruction. So here, we take 4 plus RAX and put it in RAX. So this is the same as adding, almost the same as adding 4 to RAX. Well, why I'm saying almost the same, we'll talk about condition codes and that will be why. Another way of thinking of it is that this instruction is kind of equivalent to the address of operator, the ampersand operator in C, which you have an expression that's going to be our first operand, it takes the address of that. So questions about LEA so far? So a thing which seems to confuse people about this is that, well, this instruction seems intended for dealing with memory addresses. But as far as the processor is concerned, when it sees this LEA instruction, it doesn't care if this RAX plus 4 is actually a memory address. It's not going to access memory there. To get the address of it, it's just going to compute its numerical value. So this means that you can use the LEA instruction on things which are not valid memory locations. And the compiler does this all the time. You might say, well, why would the compiler do that? Why would we use this instruction that's intended for memory locations to do just arithmetic? And well, the main reason is that this instruction is actually a very convenient way of doing arithmetic, which doesn't really have good alternatives. So, for example, I can multiply a value by 5 in one instruction by doing this. So I'm taking base RAX plus RAX times 4 and putting it in RAX. That multiplies RAX by 5. That's one instruction. Doing that in other ways is certainly possible, but not nearly as convenient. And this is often the fastest way of multiplying RAX by 5 in many processors. And so compilers will generate that. If you do it to multiply by 5 because they're being clever, they're saying, well, this is the best way of doing that on the processor you're targeting. This instruction here, LEA RBX, RCX, we have our base, RBX, we had RCX, we have no scale, so it's going to be 1, that's sort of the default value. And we put the result in RDX, so this adds two numbers together and puts it in RDX. So why would the compiler do this instead of using an add instruction? What's going on here this is better than add instruction for? Yeah, back there? preserves both the two registers for writing. Yeah, so if the compiler wanted to do something equivalent without this, it would have to do something like move RCX into RDX and then add into RDX from RBX, like that. It would be two instructions. So the compiler saved an instruction by using LEA to do an add. Okay, so questions on these examples? Yeah?
Can you explain the times 5 part?
Can I explain the times 5 part? So if we remember our sort of general version of the address syntax, that given this, this turns into memory at displacement plus base plus index times scale. If we do that substitution, our displacement is not specified, so it must be 0. Our base is going to be the value of RAX. Our index is going to be 4 time. Sorry, it's going to be RAX, and our scale is going to be 4. So this is 0 plus RAX times 4. And RAX plus RAX times 4 is RAX times 5. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay. So let's look at a function that a compiler generated with LEA. There's some things that are a little weird going on here. So one thing we need to remember is calling convention. So I told you you can look it up. I'll give the part we care about. So RDI slash EDI slash DI, etc. is the first argument, and the return value is in RAX slash EAX slash AX. And you might say, wait, LEAL? So this is an LEA instruction with a 32-bit result. You might say, wait a moment, addresses aren't 32 bits. So what the 32-bit version of the instruction does is it computes the 64-bit result and discards the most significant 32 bits. So, question is, what is this function? You know, what did I put in the dot 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 to get a compiler to generate this function? Give you a minute or two. You can talk with your neighbors.
Question? This question is about office hours. If there's no location, should we assume it's on Discord? We should fix there being no location. Generally, it will be on Discord evenings and some other, and certain other times, and otherwise mostly in Rice 442, though we don't have that. We don't have all the room reservations for Rice 442 worked out. Okay, so who would like some more time? Okay, a few people. Okay. Okay, so let's say, who thinks the answer is A, arc times 9, B, negative arc times 9, okay, C, times 8, D, negative arc times 7, okay, a few people, E, none of these, okay, F, there's some different prototype, I didn't even write the non-dot-dot-dot part right. Okay, so most people got the right answer, and why is it none of these? Well, it turns out that we're going to get arg times 7 without negative. So what's going on here? So we have this here is EAX gets RDI times 8 is what this does. Does it in the way where we have this thing, address RDI times 8, is saying memory at that location, but we don't actually access memory, we just say, well, we found the address, put it in EAX. When we do this, we're going to be truncating a 64-bit value to a 32-bit value, and this might have tempted some people to say, wait a moment, shouldn't this function take a long? And here the compiler is taking advantage of knowing that when you set EDI, you also clear the zero, the top of RDI, and it knows we don't care about any overflow. So this is OK to do, even though, yes, we're doing the computation on 64 bits and then truncating it. Second instruction here, remember it's subtract from. So this does EAX gets EAX minus EDI. So this is going to be arg times 8, because that's what we just put in EAX, minus arg, which is going to be arg times 7. And that's our return value register, so that's what this function returns. Questions on how I figured that out? Yes?
Can you explain why the value of EDI is arg?
Can I explain why the value of EDI is arg? So the calling convention says that we put the first argument in RDI or EDI or DI depending on its size. So in this case, it's an int, which is 4 bytes on 64-bit Linux. So it's going to be put in EDI. It happens that since it was put in EDI, then also put in RDI, which is why we could use RDI for it. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
Other questions? Yeah.
This question is having zero as your displacement the same as no displacement?
Yes. Displacement being the number before the parentheses. Other questions? Okay, so that's. Okay, so let's. So there's some stuff we won't talk about in assembly. There's one more thing we are going to talk about. So some stuff we want to talk about, I guess I should mention it briefly because you might see it in, like, when you're disassembling things. So we're not going to talk about floating point or vector stuff. We'll talk about vector stuff later in the semester. But there's this bunch of extra registers, XMM0 through XMM15. We won't talk about something called segmentation at all because it's mostly historical. And there's a ton of instructions that, well, if you see them, look them up. No one, x86 has like 1,000 instructions where no one's gonna expect you to know all of them. Okay, so we're talking about conditionals. So you've done stuff with conditionals in 2150 where you like do conditional jumps, and you may remember that, oh, you can like, if you want to do if rax is not equal to 0, call foo. A way we can do that is we can compare rex to 0 and do this jump if equal to skip over the call. And one thing that I believe 2150 kind of glosses over is how this works. So one question is that this compare and this jump if equal are different instructions. And you probably kind of learned them as a pair of instructions you put together, which is fine to do. But one question is, like, how does it work if they're different instructions? And another thing you might want to ask is, well, what if I put something else in this in between? Like, what if I put, like, move 100 into RAX here? What is the jump? Do we call foo or not? And we're going to talk about how this jump if equal instruction works and how this compare instruction works. How does the value get between them? And that will also answer the question of, like, what if I do other things in between? How does that affect what happens? The answer is, well, there's some special registers for passing the value from the comparison to the conditional jump instructions, which are called condition codes. And as the slide says, they are set by almost all arithmetic instructions. You might say, wait a moment. Why almost all? Shouldn't they just be set by compare? And we'll talk about that. But the designers of x86 and many other similar instruction sets made the choice that we're going to have these condition codes set by pretty much everything. And the condition codes basically store information about the last arithmetic result. And you might say, wait a moment, compare isn't arithmetic, it's a comparison. But it turns out that under the hood, compare actually is just doing arithmetic. It's not really doing a comparison itself. So our condition code instructions, using instructions like jump if greater, jump if less than or equal, read the condition codes, and they're named assuming that the last thing you did is subtraction and based on sort of the result of that. And one, probably the most direct way of thinking about it is that they're like kind of comparing the result of the last thing to zero. Or another way is like if we did a subtraction, they're based on what that means as a comparison. That's sort of our hint about what compare actually does. So compare does a subtraction and sets condition codes based on the result. And our conditional jump instructions say, oh, jump if greater than means the result was positive, meaning that the value we were subtracting from was bigger than the other value. And we'll look at some examples of this, which should make it clearer later. So the condition codes, I told you they're about the last
arithmetic result, but we don't actually just store the last result. We store a summary of it in a few bits. And those bits on x86, the main ones, there's some others we're not going to talk about very much, is going to be what we call the zero flag and the sign flag. So the zero flag is, was the result zero? So if we think about a subtraction, if we subtract two values and get zero, that means the two values we subtracted were the same. So that's how this is useful for doing comparison. So jump if equal jumps if the zero flag is one, because that means that when we did a subtraction, which it turns out compare would have done, or we could have done some other way, that the two values must have been equal. There's also a sign flag, which is, was the result negative? You might say, why is this called sign flag? So if you remember choose complement, at the most significant bit of our choose complement numbers, we had a sign bit, and this sign flag is just a copy of that sign bit. So jump if less than checks for the sign flag being 1, and you can think of that as, did we subtract and get a negative number? And jump if less than or equal, for example, checks for the sign flag being 1 or the zero flag being 1. Now, one thing we're going to kind of, I want you to know is a thing that we have, the processors have to deal with, but that we're going to kind of ignore when we build our sort of own processors, is that we have to deal with overflow. So, like normally when I subtract two values and one is less than the other, or subtract, a small value from a greater value, I expect to get a negative number, but sometimes we have overflow and that won't happen. And we need our comparison to work even in that case. So the way x86 handles this is that there's these two other flags to tell us if overflow happened, called the overflow flag, which is tells us if overflow happened if we think of things as sign computation, or the carry flag, which tells us if overflow happened if we think of things as unsigned. We're going to not really use these this semester. In particular, we're having you build sort of a simple processor that has a subset of x86. Our subset of x86 doesn't implement these flags, and therefore will handle overflow incorrectly. And we're not going to care. Obviously, if you were building a processor for people to actually use, you probably would want to handle that detail, but I just don't think it's very interesting to implement. One thing about these flags for did it overflow is this is why you may know that x86 has two different versions of the conditional jump instruction. So there's a jump less than and a jump below. And the difference between them is whether they look at whether it overflowed as a sign computation or an unsigned one. So whether they treat the computation that we did, the arithmetic, as signed or unsigned. So questions about sort of what our raw condition codes are? Yeah.
How does it check that CF equals 1 or not? Because that seems sort of circular in that we're doing a comparison by doing another comparison.
So how does it, so the question is, how do we use the carry flag for one of these conditional jump instructions? So the way I would think about it is basically that if CF is 1, it kind of reverses how you look at the sign flag.
Yeah, but or checking if CF is
1. Oh, CF, sorry. How does checking if CF is 1? How does it read the value of the flags? So you can think of the flags as just an extra thing in the register file, so like RIX. The instruction can access them. There are ways of retrieving the flags into normal registers, which probably work in the same way. So basically, the flags are like a hidden register you can't name. That's how I would look at it.
Okay, and then how does it check the value, essentially? Because it's doing a comparison to check the value.
Question, how does it check the value? So,
how does it check whether it's 0 or 1?
So there's just some hard-coded circuitry that handles the cases. And this is much simpler than doing a general comparison because basically we're just, looking at two or three, three bits for all the types of conditional jumps. We're looking, for jump less than or jump less than equal, we're looking at the zero flag, the sign flag, and the overflow flag. And just combining them, that's just some hard-coded circuitry to handle that. Does that answer your question? Okay, other questions? Okay, so the condition codes, as I said, they're special registers. You can't access them normally, but they're there. They actually store values. And if you've looked at the debugger, when you type info registers, they show up as part of this special eFlags register. So you see here that the zero flag is set, and the sign flag, overflow flag, and carry flag aren't mentioned, so they must be not set. And also, there are some other flags that we don't talk about, which are not condition code. Well, one of them is a condition code, and one of them's not. But there's some extra flags in that sort of flags register. So you can see them in the debugger, and this means that they're saved somewhere, in between instructions. Okay, so questions about our flags so far. So let's look at example here. So here I move negative 10 into REX, then I move 20 into RBX, and then I compute 20 minus 10 to get 30. And the result is greater than 0. So this jump less than or equal to 0 should not be taken. It shouldn't jump. And how is it going to know that? So let's go through what the flags are going to be. So we have our 0 flag, which is the result of this 0? Well, no, it's 30. So the 0 flag is 0. And we have the sign flag, which is the result of this negative? No, it's not. And the jump less than or equal is going to say, well, that means that it's not less than or equal to 0. The jump less than or equal to is going to say, okay, don't jump. So questions about that logic? Yes?
Can you use the jump
with compare? And if so, in what order? So the question is, what happens if we use this with compare? So, yeah, so I was going to get to it later, but we'll just preview it, that the result of the jump is exactly the same every time if I replace the subtract with a compare. The only difference is the compare is not going to edit RBX.
Okay, thank you.
So the compare instruction is just a subtract that doesn't write the result to the destination, but it does all the work with the flags. Other questions? So we can look at some other examples to see how the flags are being used. So if I take 20 minus 20, I get 0. Jump less than or equal to will be taken because it must look at the 0 flag and say, oh, it's 0. That means the values were equal in the subtraction, and it's less than or equal. And similarly, if I get a negative result, that means the sign flag is 1. So jump less than or equal, we can conclude from this, is jump if ZF equals 1 or SF equals 1. Plus something for overflow that we aren't going to show. Some questions throughout this example. So you see we just look at the result of the subtraction. We're basically, jump less than or equal is basically comparing that to 0, which is the same as comparing the two numbers that we subtracted. Okay. And so, as I mentioned, for our, compare is subtraction, but it doesn't store the result. There's another instruction you might see called test, which is a bitwise AND, and doesn't store the result. Most common way you'll see this is that the compiler will generate code that ANDs the same value with itself, with this test instruction, which produces a result of, you know, that value, and then uses that to set the condition codes. Yes? So test is like compare, and that it computes a value, it doesn't store the result, but instead of computing it by subtracting, it computes it by doing a bitwise AND. The most common way you'll see this is that a compiler will generate code that tests a value with itself, and that will compute a value which is the same, the source operand. So in this case, RAX will be used to set the condition codes, meaning, for example, if RAX is 0, ZF will be 1, which is usually how you'll see it used. So yeah, to give a more complete example, if I do JE foo, this is jump to foo if RAX was 0. And yes, it works this way even though we're not really checking for equality, but the jump conditional jump instructions are named after compare, even though they use the flags in the same way, regardless of how they were set. So it turns out most instructions that set things use, you know, the compute something, set the condition codes. And we have these two instructions that only set the condition codes, compare and test. And there's some instructions that compute things that don't set the condition codes. LEA is one. So LEA doesn't actually set condition codes. Move, that computes an address sometimes, doesn't set condition codes. All the control flow instructions, arguably they compute stuff. You know, like call computes a stack address, doesn't set the condition codes. And you might say, how would I know that LEA, that I learned is a great way to multiply by 5, doesn't set condition codes? And the answer is, you check the processor's manual. They made an arbitrary decision, and to really know what it is, you have to look it up. Okay, so we mentioned that we have our sort of standard compare. So let's say, why would we have instructions that aren't compare and test set the condition codes? Why did the designers of x86 decide that that was a good idea? Because I told you already, they've made arbitrary decisions about what instructions do and don't set the condition codes. So they clearly don't have to set them all the time. And there's a particular pattern which is pretty handy, which is that, you know, often when we can write loops in a way where we do this loop and we have a counter that's going to 0, and it turns out that in that case, we want to compare to 0 to do a logic to see if we go back to the beginning of the loop. That'd be sort of the most natural way for the compiler to write the loop. And, well, we can just omit the compare to 0. We can just do the subtraction. And the condition codes are just set for us. The compare to 0 is kind of implicit on every subtract instruction. So. So this is probably the sort of reason why they said, oh, it's good to have all the instructions and the condition codes. So that there are cases like this where we can just compute something and just naturally use the results to do our conditional jump and not have an extra instruction to do a comparison. Okay, so questions? So we learned a bit about how condition codes work. So let's do a little exercise. So remember that SF equals 1 if the result is negative, and ZF equals 1 if the result is 0. my question here is I have some code here, and after I run this whole snippet, my question is, what is the SF and ZF, assuming no overflow occurs? Give you a minute to work through that. And what are the possible values? Is more than one might be possible. Who would like some more time? Who would still like some more time? Okay, so who thinks A is possible? Okay, thinks B is possible? Okay, who thinks C is possible? Okay. Who thinks D is possible? Okay, so most people have concluded that A and B are possible, and nothing else. And I guess the first thing to think about is, okay, so SF and ZF, what are they being set by? And the answer is that the value we're going to have is this last add instruction. You might say, wait, doesn't subtract set it? Yes, it does. Unfortunately, it gets overwritten because the add is late. So then we need to figure out what this computes. And if we call RCX C, well, we put C into RDX. We subtract 1 from that, so we get C minus 1. Then we add C minus 1 and C to get 2C minus 1. And C starts out as an integer, so we can see that it's not possible. If we try to solve 2C minus 1 equals 0, we find out that C would have to be not an integer for that to happen. So the 0 flag cannot be 1. So that eliminates the last two. And then we have a question of, well, are both of them possible? And arguably, there's some information I probably should have told you to answer this question. So let's do an example value of C. So let's say C is 0, and then we compute 0 minus 1 to get minus 1. And I said assuming no overflow, and I think what everyone assumed by that is that I was thinking of these as sine numbers, so minus 1 would be representable. But I probably need to specify that, because if we think of these as unsigned numbers, then that this is an overflow. So overflow and RCX and RDX are signed numbers, are signed. So we think of those as unsigned, that has requires, you know, that negative number is an overflow there. We have to be concerned about that. But it only makes sense for them to be signed because probably we wouldn't be looking at the sign flag if we didn't think of them as signed. Okay. So then we add, you know, so then if we're doing our minus 1 example, we have minus 1 plus 0 equals minus 1, and that has a sign flag of 1. So this tells us that definitely B is possible. And I can come up with an example for A by just choosing a big number for C. Like if I choose 100 for C, I get D, you know, so I have 100. So I get 100 minus 1 equals 99. And then I have 99 plus 100 equals 199. And that's going to give us A. So questions? I came up with that answer. Okay, so another thing about how condition codes work. Let's do jump greater than or equal to. So it's ignoring the overflow case. When should it jump? So this is sine greater than or equal to. It should jump based on y. So remember, it's named after subtraction because that's what a compare does. So what condition code should we be looking for this greater than or equal to case? And you can think of it as comparing, or alternately, you can think of it as comparing the result to greater than or equal to 0. Who'd like some more time? Okay, so who thinks A, B, C, D, okay, E, and F. Okay, so I want to select one, but so I think of the non-overlapping answer. So jump greater or equal to. The way we can think of this is jump if result is greater than or equal to 0. Okay, great. So when is that going to be true? So let's think about what these mean. So A is exactly 0. So that is a case where we want to jump, but it's not the only case, right? That covers one example of results. SF equals 1, this is negative. This is not what we want. So SF equals 1 and ZF equals 0, this we can read as negative, because SF, remember, sign flag, if it's 1, it's negative. Negative and 0, and not 0, which is the same as negative. 0, so that is not what we want. Here, this is saying negative or 0, and we don't want to jump if it's negative, so D is not a correct choice. And I think E is our best choice here. This is not negative. So this includes 0, even though I'm not checking if the 0 flag is 1, because, well, we want to jump if result is like 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, so we don't actually care what the 0 flag is. Even though if we see 0 flag is 1, we do know we want to jump, we don't actually need to check that. So questions about how I figured this out? So we have our condition codes. We learn they're set by arithmetic. Usually we'll see them set by compare or subtraction, but they don't have to be. And we have our conditional jump instructions. We're going to mostly be using these signed comparison ones. We also mentioned there's some unsigned ones, jump above and so on. And these check the condition codes. So now we know how to do sort of conditional stuff in assembly, and this is theoretically review, but I'm going to go through sort of my process for taking some code with normal ifs, loops, and so on, and converting it to assembly. So the process I like to do is I have some C code here. If B is greater than 42, A plus equals 10, otherwise A times equals B. And I want to convert this to assembly. The process I like doing is I first convert this to C with go-tos. Why do I do that? Because after I do that, I now have a bunch of lines which each have sort of a natural translation to assembly. So this first line here, this is a compare and a conditional jump. So I rewrote this still using C, so I'm not going to assembly yet. And I said, okay, so we have to skip this A plus equals 10 sometimes. That's why I flipped the condition here. And also I have to skip the A times equals 10, so I have a go-to for that. So this just systematically went through and said, when do I skip over this block of code? Let's write a statement for that. That's of the four if something go-to. Or the case where we skip unconditionally, just go-to. And this is actually valid C code. Not that I ever recommend writing C code like this, other than for this type of purpose of converting to assembly, but C actually does support go-to. Probably don't use it that much. So once I have this code here, I can just go sort of line by line and translate that to assembly. So I can say, oh, this first line is compare jump less than, second line's an add, third line's a jump, fourth line's a multiply, and end up with code, assembly code like this. Questions sort of about my process for writing assembly code from C with, you know, if, else, and so on. Okay, so let's look in the other direction. So I have some assembly code here, and it's the same as which of these C snippets? Tell me.
can check with your neighbor, see if you... Okay, who'd like some more time? Okay, I see a few people. Okay, so who thinks A is a simple, B, C, D, none of them, no clue. Okay, so we have a big split. So I did sort of, so we have sort of these basic instructions, RBX minus equals RAX, that's what the subtract is, RCX plus equals RBX is what this add is. So we just need to figure out what this jump of equal is. And remember, generally we can think of the jumps as being named as comparing the result to zero. So this is jump if result equals zero. And what's the result? Well, it's the last thing we computed in arithmetic, so that's going to be based on the value of RCX. So it's comparing RCX to zero, but when RCX equals zero, we're going to after. We're not running the next instruction. So it turns out that none of these match, but it's the A, but with the comparison flipped. And I'm mentioning this, have this example, because flipping these comparisons is the most common error I see from students trying to work out this stuff, is forgetting that, oh, we're jumping over something in that case. So questions on this example. Okay, so I've showed sort of translating if to assembly. We can apply the same idea to translating like while loops to assembly. So while loop is a, basically we skip over the whole loop if the condition's not true, and rather than keeping going at the end, we go back to the beginning. That's one way of translating it. And that gives us code something like this. Okay, so questions? Yeah.
I guess we need it for the start of the loop, but for the intermediate loop steps, do we actually need that compare?
Question, for the intermediate loop steps, do we need this compare at the beginning? It turns out, no, we could omit that. And a clever compiler would figure that out, yes. So I was going to have an exercise on which of these is correct, but we'll go to the sort of skip, which is that compilers are aware that, oh, I can omit compare sometimes, and often will reorganize loops to take advantage of that sort of thing. So we have, I have these three versions of this while loop that a compiler generated, and these are all valid versions. And what the compiler is doing here is just is mostly moving around where the comparisons are. So in this second example here, it followed your idea of, oh, don't we not need to do that compare at the beginning? So it said, we'll do a special compare at the beginning, and we'll have the compare at the end of the loop here to avoid that. And why did the compiler think this was a better good idea? Why should we assume that the second one might be faster? Yeah. There's fewer instructions in the loop. So if we're just counting instructions, which I mentioned isn't exactly performance, but it's related, we have 5 instructions in the loop here and 4 instructions in the loop here. So assuming we have a lot of iterations, we're going to run a lot less instructions for the second code. If we only have one iteration, not really, but
we have enough iterations, we're going to run a lot of less for this. And then we have this third version where I don't think I have the time to do the full explanation, but basically what the compiler did is it converted this from a loop that counts up to 10 to a loop that counts down to 0. And why did it do that? Because it ended up where the actual loop part has 3 instructions instead of 4. By counting down from 0, we avoided a comparison. And this might be worth it if we have a lot of iterations of this loop. Like, if typically we have 3, probably not a good idea. But that's something compilers can do, and this is just other ways of writing these loops. So questions about these different versions of this while loop? Okay. And one other thing I want to mention as we're finishing up, mainly because you'll see this in the bomb lab, is how switch statements are compiled. So we talked about compiling loops, like we have this sort of translation to if else. We can do this for switch statements, but we have a lot of options. So one thing we can do is we can do this kind of as a, you know, compare with 1, compare with 2, compare with 3. That's one option. But we could be more clever than that. We could do a binary search. So we could compare with 50 and like have code for the lower half of the switch and the upper half of the switch. Or we can do an option called a jump table, where we just have an array. Here, just this is a constant array of pointers to the code for case 1, case 2, and so on. And we do a jump indexing into that array. So what this ends up doing is we have this array of list of code addresses. We do a lookup in that array with this fancy jump instruction, and that jumps to the machine code directly for the write case. And compilers will do all 3 of the strategies I showed for compiling switch statements sometimes, depending on, you know, their settings and what the switch statement looks like and so on. And that's where I'll finish up today. So next time we're going to talk about object files and other things within, you know, that we've missed from translating from assembly or from seed code all the way to machine code. See you on Thursday.